So, hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Daily Medieval Podcast. So as of now, we have had best-selling authors. We've had maritime archaeologists, castle archaeologists, and popular historians. But today I'm joined with someone with a fairly unique job title, an ethno-historian. So here to tell me all about her incredible work on digital archives, archipelagos, language, all of that stuff is Dr. Alicia Coulson.
Yeah.
Welcome. Thank you ever so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. I'm really quite excited, actually. As I said earlier before we started, this is fun. It's actually fun talking about what is ethnohistory.
Yeah. No, 100%. So, I mean, let's get straight into it. Quite simply, what is an ethnohistorian?
Ethnohistorian actually uses historical data, anthropological data, generally looks at sort of indigenous and non-Western peoples and uses archaeological data, ethnographic data, archival data, oral information, which I'm sure strikes the fear into everyone because they suddenly go, yikes, how do I A, collect it, B, go in the sort of quote unquote abstract room about and sort of with my agenda and being mine, sort of, you know, in quotes, because it's not generally mine, it's just an agenda of, you know, you have, people generally have research questions that they wish to answer, and we all know that when you often go and approach a project thinking, yeah, I'd like to ask this questions of these documents, and you invariably read them and go, can't kind of answer, didn't really quite get what I wanted.
Yeah.
But actually, it's actually pretty groovy or whatever, you know. But so knowing that the person, you're not going to sort of query a document, you're actually going to talk to a bunch of people who do answer back. And may actually say, no, your whole research journey is complete baloney. Or they may say, we don't like you. Which is, you know, or we don't like you people, as in insert the type of person. I mean, I have heard, I was talking to some people in Treaty 3, which is in northwestern Ontario, and it was sort of from the very beginning, back when I was, well, I'm actually an archaeologist as well. When I was being an archaeologist, but one of my field supervisor was like, you know, you need to meet the people whose record you actually happen to be looking at. So I was like, okay, I understand that the descendants, yes, And one of them said, who was, I would say, in his 60s, and sort of like grandfather generation. I don't like archaeologists, they're all dreadful. And I was like, oh, okay. Gosh. And so it's sort of like, just on there. Yeah, well, definitely put in my place. And so it was a case of, okay, I'm going to have to learn how to do this. And it was a case of, yeah, you have a textbook, but we know there's, it goes back to that whole question of theory and practice. So
yeah, I find that fascinating as well, especially because I guess a large part of your job, especially when you're working with communities, is about, I guess, building trust before you can even get down to the dirty work, you know, and that's something that I don't get, obviously, with medieval history, because, well, no one's alive. But it's really fascinating, especially when you say about the research questions, because that's obviously something that, well, I've been taught at university to do, is always, you know, have a list of research questions that you go into looking at your manuscript, whatever it may be. But it's almost as if, especially with your role, it's, you do it the other way around, which I almost think I would prefer, which is to say, here's a manuscript that no one's looked at or that I'm going to look at, you know, and then just see what comes from it, and to then build then your questions off of that as well.
I'll tell you what happens. I mean, because I was put into, normally, as you know, we go into a scenario and you have a bunch of questions. It's like you're facing your document and you're like, I'd like to answer these questions and I wonder how this document fits into what I'm looking at. I was contacted by an elder during lockdown because I kept seeing this person appearing on my academia profile. And I was like, who you are? And then I got an email from someone called George Kenny, and he wrote me saying, hi, I'm an elder from this community. I'd like to chat to you because I want to talk about the meanings of some paintings in a particular part of Ontario. And I was like, Okay, this appeals to me on several grounds. A, I'm actually interested in pictographs as an archaeologist, and B, actually, it'd be quite fun talking to somebody who actually is from this community. And I kept thinking, I don't, and I because I haven't spoken to anyone for a long time, because obviously here we are, sort of stuck in our houses, going, I've got to do something, and trying to find things to do. And he, so I said, okay, here's a Zoom link. Thinking, never done, feel no, what's happening here? And it was a sort of total unknown. It was like, and he, and then, so we did the whole Zoom thing, and he clicked on the link, and it was like, hi, and he's like, hello, and I was like, don't, and it was really strange because it was just totally different. And I get had the sensation that things were being flipped, but I was like, okay, I'm gonna go with this, don't know where it's going. And he says, hi, I'm the son of a shaman, and I'd like to tell you all about a pictograph site, a rock painting site, which my dad painted. I'll tell you about the
Whoa.
meanings and what's the importance, and then and something called Anishinaabe Ishigewin, which is animism, and it's their way of how do you know what animism is at all? I'm not sure.
Somewhat.
And so, and he's like, so we're going to have chats, and I'd like to write an academic article because I know that that's what you guys do. You write academic articles. And I was like, okay. So it was strange because the reason it was flipped, because he was giving me the agenda. It wasn't me going in and saying, hi, I'd like to study my work. Let's ask, if we could sort of meet 3 times a week for an hour and have a cup of tea, because I know they like, the indigenous north, they like drinking cups of tea. It's like sharing. So I just kept thinking, okay, you're basically driving the research agenda. You've decided. And he's like, don't like archaeologists or anthropologists, dreadful lot. And I was like, oh, okay, right. Okay, I see where we're going. All right. So it was very clear how it was. And so initially he told me lots of tall stories to pull my leg, see whether I, and I, and the thing was, it was a circle, which is a traditional, so it's himself, his son, his niece, and several other people. One, and they would all watch, is she gonna fall for this one? So I passed, but it was a total role reversal where I had to, they wanted to see, did I understand how to be part of that group, and did they trust me, rather than. So I was the sort of the specimen, if you could put it the other way around. Normally when we go in as researchers to look at something, we're the people looking down the magnifying glass, a microscope. And then it was the other way around. I was the person. And I was like, well, what, why me? Now we're on, sort of, I can now say, hi, George, we're on first name terms. Why me? And he's like, oh, like the PhD supervisor. And I'm like, okay, now this is getting creepy.
Fair enough.
So I was like, okay. So I think, yeah, it's a different set of skills. It's a lot of sort of patience, and I have to know that I might have a cop. We might just, as he says, sometimes we chat every Saturday on Zoom, and sometimes it's like I learn an awful lot about hockey, and I'm like, ice hockey, and or we sh shoot the breeze. It's like you shoot the breeze about films, about sports, about all sorts of stuff. But then he's like, oh yeah, let's just talk about, we're here just to talk about this, and this will be sort of near the end of the conversation. And if you're a sort of a classically trained researcher, like, get to the point, but you can't say that, because if you can't, I can't, I know anyway, in these communities, you can't ask a direct question.
Gosh.
And so it's a case of, okay, I'm just gonna have to wait and wait and wait. And so I have a number of questions, obviously, because he knows I've read. It's a bit weird because he actually knows more about me than I know about him. But he's from the indigenous community there, so they will ask around. They've got their own, and so he's obviously found out who I worked with in terms of archaeological field work. And I know he has, because he's like, oh, I know you know X. And I'm like, okay,
Gosh.
gosh, okay. So it's different, but it's fun, because you get to hear what people think. They'll tell me bluntly what they think of the early explorers. Or they'll or so and so didn't know what he was talking about. I'm like, is that just your point of view? Or so, for example, they told me about the collection. There's a an early ethnographer who went in 1919 to their community, and is, I don't know how well good your geography is. Do you think they are okay? They're in the Canadian Shield, so you have Toronto. You fly from Toronto, you go to Thunder Bay. It's like 2.5 hour flight. And then you drive straight north as far as you can. Then you sort of at the end of the road, and that's the beginning of their community.
Wow.
And so the people, the reports, there are people who have just gone in and they just wanted to know what was there. So we'll look at black and white photographs and they'll say, oh yeah, that's cousin so-and-so and that's so-and-so. And it's really interesting because it doesn't, there's no indication on the photographs. So I actually learn more about these black and white photographs that we'd either just like flip-flip.
Yeah.
Okay, so they all identify relatives and important items that were important in terms of sort of sacred or religious, have religious holdings. So it's really fun. It means that I'm sort of in between, by being an ethnohistorian, I'm in between sort of archaeology and anthropology and all these in them. So you can pull it together.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely incredible and fascinating. Just brilliant. I love how it turns your role almost turns history on its head. And I mean, I'm used to such a structured system, you know, of like, this is how you should tackle this essay or dissertation or research or whatever it may be. This is how you should become a historian. This is how you should do archaeology. Whereas it seems like as well, the way that you're doing it is almost, it's extremely fluid and flexible, and it reflects, I guess, the cultures that you're working with, really, in the way that you do it. And I find it absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's fun because at the same time, he knows that I know how to do archaeology the outsider way. He's like, and then so we have to deal with this notion of insider and outsider, and it really reflects on how much knowledge you have of them. So they are the insider. We are actually the outsider.
Mm.
So he'll say, well, if I know you do, he studied archaeology, and he's like, well, you have these things called theories, and we're like, yeah, we do. And he's like, you've got these big cheeses, and I'm like, yeah, we do. And then he'll say, well, he missed off X, didn't he understand that? I was like, well, you know, he's got a framework, he's got a theoretical structure, he wants to try and find out these things, and he's like, well, why didn't they just ask?
Gosh, I love that. That's brilliant. The thing I love as well is because I personally focus on like religious history within medieval history, especially on miracle stories and stuff like that. I'm about to start writing a book about a new history of the medieval era through saints and their stories, because I find that kind of like what you've kind of touched upon, kind of the using oral history and kind of the way that people interacted with their societies can almost tell you a lot more about kind of, I guess, the themes or whatever it may be of the history itself than say, you know, King John did such and such and this war then happened and blah, blah, blah. And so I just absolutely, I think there's such a large place and for oral history. And yet it seems almost, I mean, I don't know, would you say it's dismissed almost?
Well, I think, we go back to this sort of question, what is university and disciplines? And I think some disciplines have particular, I mean, if I look at archaeology, they will say, we only studied this and we've got these frameworks and we've got theory and method and we've got these established methods. And I think that everyone is so concerned to sort of carve out a niche that, and they use their own sort of West Judeo-Christian Western perspective. And I think when you come to a group who are indigenous or non-Western, they don't organize knowledge in the same way.
Yeah.
And so they don't see, well, they'll expect me to know how to identify fish. But if I was an archaeologist, I would say, well, yeah, that's a zoo. And with my archaeology head hat on, because I have to admit I am. But if I put my archaeology hat on, I would say, well, there's no archaeologists that can do that. The biologists will know all about that, but that's that. When I talk to George, he's an elder, he's a knowledge keeper, he'll say, yeah, but don't you know, you know what a sucker is, don't you? You know what the traits are, you know what it looks like, you know how to identify it. So it's like, it becomes a clash of two paradigms. So I have to, I think as the person in between, I've got to be able to say, okay, yes, I know with my outsider hat on, I'm going to use this term, it's just easy. Outsider hat on, I've got to recognize that we've got these things called disciplines. And it's a way of organizing information for our purposes.
Yeah.
But when it comes to trying to understand something made by another group who are animals, essentially, they won't organize information in the same way. So I can't say, well, I don't know, I'm not a biologist. I have to say, well, yes, it's a sucker, and the name is this. And why is it important? Well, from his perspective, it's because you don't eat your own relatives. Because he's from the bear clan, and so you have a relation, you obviously have to eat because they're hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
And so you need to know the relationships between the different animals, so you need to know how to deal with them, because that doesn't just affect the people who you talk to, but it affects how you deal with, you know, their animal relatives, as non-humans.
Gosh, that's amazing. So I want to quickly, I guess, go back, because we're talking about, I guess, you now, contemporary you, whereas I would like to quickly go back, and I want to, because I find your journey and your story and your inspirations to becoming where you are now deeply fascinating as well. So I'd love to know kind of where did your pursuit of history begin, and what has been your journey to where you are now?
That's opened a big question. When I saw it, I was like, yikes.
It's quite a heavy question.
I have to admit, my dad's a historian, my mother's an anthropologist, so they've always been asking me questions about wherever I went, and so I was always sort of curious, why is that that way, why is it? So I ended up asking these questions myself, because my parents were always saying, well, why is that tree there, or, you know, what's the meaning of the house, what's the house made out of, what's the building made out of, is it wattle and daub, is it this, and then asking more and more questions. And so I think from the earliest age possible, really, one of those children who just went why, and everyone's
no, but I find that I think that's brilliant, because again, like, going back to like your research and everything, and something that I'll ask later, is about kind of the idea of looking at things from different perspectives and kind of going against the grain of the traditional, I guess, way of looking at things, which is definitely something I think more people need to do. So your most recent research has been about an archipelago in southern Brazil, if I'm right. So what drew you to this topic?
Well, first of all, I have to admit, I had lived there, and I found it fascinating that, so I'd been around it, I knew the places, and I found it really interesting because in Brazil I knew what it was, but when I came back to England I noticed no one knew where it was, and how it was just like, well, why? But actually it was really important for the 17th, 18th, 19th century, who was going to run southern Brazil and who's going to control the route to China for silver. So it was a sort of, it was the linchpin between the Spanish and the Portuguese Empire in terms of control and eventual domination of the land below it. Because I don't know if you remember where it is. It's actually a clump of islands off the coast of Santa Catarina, which is just north of, you have Argentina and then Uruguay and then the southernmost state in Brazil, which is Rio Grande do Sul, and then you have it off the coast. So it's actually a big, the biggest island. There's 33 islands. And I thought that was really cool. Isn't that cool? An archipelago of 33 islands. And the vegetation is really amazing. They have sort of tropical forests, and they have interior lagoons and waterfalls. And it's a sort of your ideal islands as a kid. Tropical island, and you can wander around it, and it's just quite exciting. So I just thought, exciting place. I was also, I decided to do it because I actually won a fellowship with the Royal Geographical Society.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you've ever heard, Wiley digitized the pre-1945 collections of the RGS.
Mm.
And I thought it'd be fun to see what maps were there because I really like maps.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I wonder, okay, I knew from having done a sort of brief survey, I knew that they had lots of English sort of maps of Africa and because they obviously, because of their agenda, had been heavily into it and the exploration of Africa. So I thought, I wonder what they've got in Brazil.
Mm.
Because English speakers, well, foreigners couldn't go there until after the 1800s when they allowed English and French and all that, everyone else. So I thought I'll like to have a look and see what the pre-45 archives are like. And I was just like, woohoo, this should be fun. It, exploration of the archive. And the archive itself, the digitization is amazing. So you can if you want, you can download data on slaves and all, because they have all they digitize it. So you can actually pull the data out of the graph and table and dump it into Excel. The tools are incredible. It's like research is heaven. If you have the chance to use it, go for it. I totally recommend it. So that's how I got in, dealt with Brazil. It was through that medium. And then I realized that they didn't have, the collection didn't hold some maps for the 18th century. So, and some of the 17th. So I was like, I'm a bit stuck. What do I do? So I thought, Brazilian National Digital Library. So I went there and that was just like map heaven, as was the Library of Congress and a couple of other places. So that's how I got, that's how that was built. That was really fun.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I find it amazing that as well that you use, that maps was a key part of that research. I mean, I've only used maps properly once. I was doing a project on Ethiopia in the medieval era, and one of the things I looked at was kind of various different maps, because I was researching about that they were more prominent in the medieval era than people had written about. But not many people actually use maps for research, that I find, especially in the medieval era. I mean, we use charters, financial records, blah, blah, blah. I mean, how important are maps and using them to unlock the past, really?
I think they're really important because they're driven by, I mean, that was some of the questions I had in my back in my mind when I was looking at these maps, because I realized they were maps by the Russians, of the same place, by Russians, French, English, Portuguese, and Spanish.
Mm.
And the map is actually affected by the cartographer, who's commissioned it, what is the point of the map, how is it colored, what are the what's the iconography on it, and it can tell you all this stuff. All this information, so you can actually pull out the story of the map by looking at the map and studying it in great depth. It's great fun. I mean, I started thinking about maps when I was in Brazil. I had to take geography, and I didn't know I was English because I'd forgotten, because I just didn't speak it. And I always thought England was really big because the way people spoke about it. Then we had this world map on the wall, and the teacher's like, "Well, where is England?" And I thought, it must be this big place, I don't know. And she pointed it out, and I was like, but it's tiny. It's tiny, but it's so big. It sounds so big. And I think it's because the ways people spoke about it, it's big.
Mm.
But then if you look, when I remember looking at the map of Brazil, I'm like, it's huge. But why? And so it sort of made me think,
yeah.
Okay, there's a, the actual map we're looking at is actually playing a big role in how we look at the world.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I also, especially, I mean, you've, as you've said, have lived in several countries and do work in Canada and Brazil, and also studying a period of time that was also so multicultural as well. I mean, as you say, it's Spanish, English, all these kind of different cultures interacting in this archipelago. I mean, how important is it that we study history from a non-Eurocentric and especially, I guess, a non-English perspective?
I think that's really important because I think if your language will influence how you look at the world. because obviously your language, it dictates the constructs, the way we describe things. And also it influences the discipline, if we take the discipline, because different disciplines have different disciplinary histories, and that will often change according to the country. I also think if we, for example, I think a quick one, if we look at the war, the American War of Independence, that's how, if you study history in the UK, you call that event. But Americans don't call it that. I remember just being struck, people saying American Revolution, and I'm like, okay. So what is this? And I kept thinking, I don't remember anything from school history, because we did one term on the US history, and I just kept thinking, don't, it's like, really? What are we talking about? Then I realized it's a different perspective.
No, that def I mean, that reminds me of, I used to live in Southeast Asia, and they would call the Vietnam War the American War. Again, because of perspective as well. So it's fascinating that there are different, I guess, terms for different things, that once you remove that kind of European perspective, you almost unlock a whole new world, really.
No, you do. And I noticed that a couple of years ago, I heard a talk by an American historian. He's at Yale, really interesting. He was looking at maps, and he noticed that the down the river, Mississippi River, if you found some old maps, you actually saw medieval, the land had been mapped out and given to French settlers, and the type of mapping was French, because they had a lot, and it was medieval fields. And it was just fascinating. And it was, I mean, it was a fluke. I don't know why I remember, but I think I went to the talk because I thought it was going to be about something else, but actually it's way better than I thought it would be. But it was fascinating, because it was arguing Central North America, is what we'd now call continental USA, was managed by the French, and this is the proof. And he showed all the maps, and it was just mind-boggling. And it was like, well, yeah, of course it was. You had the fur trade, but to see the maps themselves really hit home. Because yeah, you can have the fur trade, and you can think of people going down rivers in canoes and things like that, and fur trade posts, and competitors, the Scots, the English, and the French. But when you actually start seeing fields mapped on maps, you're like, oh, okay, this is about another world having another view of things. But it explains why there's a French-speaking newspaper in St. Louis.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So, obviously, another side to kind of your, I guess, your job or career and your life really is, I guess, adventure and exploration. Because recently you've become a member of the Explorers Club, class of 2022. I mean, firstly, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So, could you discuss a little bit about what that is, firstly, for anyone who doesn't know?
Okay, what that is, it was I got nominated to it, so it was totally, I didn't know it was happening. And it's 50 people who are changing the world, who the world needs to know about. That's the point. And it's really to get people from different disciplines talking to, who are looking at the world and exploring it mentally or physically, to talk to each other, to explain what's happening, and not the nonsense of the classic climbing up Everest or something like that. Lots of people have done it now. Or going to, I mean, there's some conservation biologists, there are some geologists, there are herpetologists, entomologists. I mean, it's just, I went to ECAD, which is the Explorers Club annual weekend, and it's like having hours of TED Talks.
Gosh, wow.
And it's really exciting and really quite fun, but you realize that knowledge is holistic. That's what sort of it's in when you hear all the talks from everyone who's in the class of 2022, everyone crosses disciplinary boundaries all the time. It's, yes, you came in as X, but you're talking across it all, and it's really fun. The idea is to push knowledge forward. and realize there is stuff to be discovered still. It's just doing it a different way. It's not the sort of the old school and no piss helmet stuff.
No, definitely. And I understand that obviously you do a lot of kind of projects and things that promote opportunities for younger people as well. I heard a thing that you did about what was it now? Kayaking with
British Exploring.
That's right. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. British Exploring. It's been around about 50 years or so.
That's right.
I went to the last one I went to is Iceland, up in northeast Iceland. We trekked up a volcano and down site and across. And it's the tree. It's very bleak. There are no trees. Well, the trees, you fall over the trees, they're about this high. So they're really short. And then we sailed across the North Atlantic on a wooden ship with three masts. That was exciting. In a storm, mainly.
Oh, gosh.
The whole point is to challenge you people to develop and to get you out of the box and to really push yourself. So people will turn up not necessarily knowing how to read a map or plan a day's walk, and they'll come out at the end being able to run everything. Essentially running it. We'll run it at the beginning. But at the end we're being told, okay, today we're going to do X, we're starting off at Y, and this is where we're going, and this is how we're getting there, this is how we're planning it. And so we will, and it's led by there's adventure leaders, and I'm a science leader, and so we teach, I think last summer it was with a friend of mine, Susanna, and we used to joke, I deal with everything that was dead, she dealt with everything that was alive. She's a biologist. It's a sort of quick way. Okay, and so as we walked, we do on average about, 16 kilometers. I think our max was 18, which is quite a lot actually in a day. And we carry backpacks, we're about 65 litres.
Oh, gosh.
So we'll stop and we'll, along the way, and we'll have, we'll talk about the biology and the plants and the life cycle. We'll look at the rocks and examine them and think about, well, why they're there, how did they get there, and really use the physical environment to have a larger discussion about our place as humans in the larger world. So we'll talk about everything from, climate change to recycling to herpetology. I mean, I did another one in Namibia, and I was chief leader then, and we had classes on herpetology.
Oh, wow.
And elephants and conservation biology and medicinal plants. I mean, it was all sorts of stuff. It's great fun. And I think we also hiked up the northeast corner of the Bramberg Mountain, which was great fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it definitely sounds it. And I think that's what's so brilliant about that. I mean, firstly, is the fact that, I mean, it seems that everything you do, there's this kind of underlying theme of about like fresh perspective, kind of thinking outside the box, I guess. But also it's brilliant as well to kind of make history, and I guess, by extension, knowledge a lot more vibrant, because I mean, I know personally, whenever someone says, oh, what do you do, and you say, oh, I do medieval history, I can see them glass-eyed and switch off. It's brilliant to be able to kind of, I guess, get people really interested in that kind of alternative way. Definitely.
Yeah, that's the whole point. I mean, it's really not, I mean, I don't mind if they run away screaming from archaeology. That's fine, or ethnohistory. But the point is to, I mean, this is the point of the British Explorer, is to make people, you can push yourself. And you can, knowledge is empowering. And, we have a connection as humans with the landscape. And to find it, and to work out how to push yourself. And I'm quite happy if no one ever wants to see geography ever again. That's fine. But the point is, use it as a next to open, just to take blinkers off your eyes and go wherever, do whatever. Because I know exactly what you mean when you mention it and you start seeing the glass.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah. I know exactly. Yeah.
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 So, I mean, I don't think I've ever come across someone who's as busy as you are, because also you've co-founded Exploration Revealed as well, which is a publication about scientific projects and exploration. How did this come about? How did you get involved with it? And how did you build it to what it is today?
Okay, this happened because of someone, because British exploring tends to draw on people who are interested in using the outdoors as a means of sparking sort of conversations and discussion and sort of building opportunities. Like, there's a series of, I kept meeting this friend who I got to know eventually, Bryony, and we would meet at talks by someone who'd gone on an adventure saying, oh, yes, I did something like they backpacked around the coast of India or something like that. And we're like, actually, that's really pretty, fun. What did you learn from it? It might be you just learned more about yourself. Well, that's fine. But we kept noticing, we kept a kept on meeting at these things. And we also had the same conversation. This is, that people didn't matter what it was. It could be a doctor who decided to go and treat polio in somewhere. There was always what was the, when they talked about the research, everyone switched off and went. And but when everyone spoke about the little side adventures, that was the really interesting stuff. Or, oh, then the fact that they remembered every stage of the Bristol stool chart. Yeah, or, which is like weirdo. But or no, or they realized that their method of taking photographs for of insects, the one that they'd learned in the lab, actually really didn't work when it came to doing it in the field. So we kept thinking, there's all these little things, and where do you? It'd be great if we could read about them, because and there must be more people who want to hear about it, and which who would be able to bring it back into whatever they were doing. And we kept meeting expedition medics. And who are medics who like going on expeditions, and they all had tales of things like polar thyroid, and both of us like, wow, what was that? It sounded pretty grim. And sort of all things like things that had crawled out of their arm and then how they extracted it, and we're just like,
Oh my gosh.
oh my God, I feel sick. But it was entertaining, and it was like, actually, there is nowhere where we can have both all of this. So we thought, why we should do something, and we kept on saying this and kept on saying this, and then it came to sort of the period, about a third of the way through the pandemic lockdown, and we're just like, why don't we just do it? And so we would on just like this, and so Brian is like, we just better get our act together. All right then. So that's what we did, and we said, okay, we need a business plan. We need to know what other publications exist out there. So we just worked out all the tasks that had to be done in order to achieve a magazine, and what it was looked like. So we got branding sorted out, and we did competitor analysis, and we looked at publishing models, how much it costs, and how to distribute it, and where to go. And then we got a charity, Scientific Exploration Society, which I don't know if you've ever heard of.
No, I can't say I have.
It's a charity which is designed to empower young people, and they actually raise funds for and give awards to people who can't find funding to do research or want to go on an exhibition or want to make a
Oh,
film or a
wow.
documentary or things like that.
That's amazing.
And then they have a talk series, and we had been meeting at these talk series, so we knew of it. So Brian was like, let's approach them because we need a sort of like a parent. Otherwise, we're just too, on our own. So, so we were, and they said, yes, we like it. And we're like, yes. And we said, we want to do digital stuff. And we're like, great. And so we're like, oh. And so we came up with a model, and we decided we would have magazine style and academic. We'd make it all short because some researchers we realized had really cool topics. And when you ask them in the pub, for example, what was your favorite experience? And they could tell you. But then when they started talking about their academic stuff, everyone else in the room was like, sort of thing. So we're like, we need somewhere to have the funky cool stuff. And we need funky cool, perhaps peer reviewed, and funky cool non peer reviewed. And in that non peer reviewed, we'd say, Okay, well, people might be taking photographs. We'll do annotated photographs or film. People might have film. People might have sound files. So we'll do all sorts of stuff. So we just had a, okay, well, what do? We need Crossref. We need this. And we looked at how to do it, and then we launched it just as the end of the last year, in 2021, actually. We launched it, and we're like, ah. So we did a little video, and then we did a call for papers, and then we've now into two. I mean, it's really, and we have social media accounts for it. We have an Instagram. We're a bit sort of, we're actually looking for it. Hello, is there anyone wants to come do social media? Because we need one, because we're not great, because we have to do it ourselves, and it's like, oh no. It's just it means it's all the fun stuff that gets missed out of all the archaeology or all the reports or all the academic articles, all the fun bits that people, the conversations in the pub, basically. If
No.
I think it was, if we would say, yeah, it's the convo in the pub where you talk about, oh, I had my leg nearly bitten off by an alligator, but I'm all right. But it's, and this is what I learned from it. So it's the little bit, what did you learn? That's what it's about, really. So it's science fiction. We called it, okay, science of exploration, but it's really field work expedition when you go on a trip and you realize that you thought you'd made a book deal and you got a bargain on your waterproof backpack, but you really didn't. So you're like, take that brand.
No, I think that's brilliant, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, like, in doing these interviews, I kind of went, before I did them, I was like, okay, there's multiple ways I could do this. I could say, oh, could you come on and give me a lecture about, I guess, the history of this archipelago? But I was like, no, I find way more interesting is about, like, one of the questions really was, your journey, how, the good, the bad, the ugly, the brilliant things, all the different things, which I think are almost so much more interesting than, having someone come on and tell you about, his, let me tell you 50 minutes about a medieval king or whatever it may be,
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, and you see, that's what we wanted, because we thought, yes, how, only if someone has a talk in a pub, which is where these talks usually are, you can get them talking for 50 minutes, but it's the stuff that's afterwards that's often way more interesting, when people will come away and say, hey, yeah, do you remember that cool conversation, when he mentioned blah blah blah, and we're like, can we like package it? And so we'll actually go up sometimes and say, can we just hack it that bit? Could you write it for us, please? On the grounds that that is, it's fun. So that's what we're having. I mean, now we're in issue three, and it should be, we've got some things up there up our sleeve for issue three, so it should be quite exciting.
No, that's fabulous. And now, you are turning towards a new, I guess, area of research about universities themselves.
Yeah.
And I mean, as gathered from your experiences and also personally as well, I mean, people have a lot of love-hate relationships with the university, I guess, institution, the system, whatever it may be. So what is your research, and I guess how can we change certain aspects about university for the better?
Oh God, what a question. That's
I
like the
know,
$1 million
a
thing.
heavy one.
It's like, oh no. What's it about? It's really, I was interested in. Been doing it for a while, and it's sort of been the background. It's really, why has it become more corporate? Because if you're looking at it from the European side, it's been around for about 1,000 years, and it was sort of looking at the pedagogy and how do we teach. Well, we used to have, so we didn't do big lectures or the tutorial model, and depending on where you are in the world, it was doing that. So I was looking at it from the point of view of the US, and why is the US having a crisis? And I was, why did I do that? I was sort of curious where it came from, because the US borrowed a variant of the German model, German Humboldtian model, and they use the tutorial model, much like so Oxford and Cambridge use the Oxbridge model, where it's the teaching is 1 to 3 or 4. And London is 1 to 8, but this all changed when we suddenly increased in numbers in the mid-90s. So what am I interested in? I'm really interested in, well, why is it on the verge of collapse, and why is,░ And why isn't the US, really looking at it in the US, why is it being threatened by this big student loan debt crisis? And the student loan debt is so big, it's bigger than the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis. And
Gosh.
it's been sold off to Germany and France. It's just sort of mind-boggling. It's like,
Yeah.
why?
Isn't crazy.
It's crazy.
It is
And
crazy.
it is crazy. And it was really okay, we all have to have an education. And some people want to go to university. Not everyone does. But some people want to do education continually. So how do you fund it? So it's really sort of, so that's the sort of, I'm deciding my angle. But there's so much information that I could sort of spend ages.
I can imagine you could go on forever, I
Yeah,
think,
you
about some
could.
of the different things.
Yeah. So I'm really doing it with an American academic who is saying, I think you need to do this and look at that. So it's fun, but I'm playing around with a couple of angles at the moment, but so I'm not going to talk about it. So it will come eventually.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So, I mean, lastly, is there any advice you would give to someone wanting to become an ethnohistorian or like yourself?
Well, that's a question. Oh, you see, that's a tough one because I only fell into it because my supervisor decided I am an archaeologist and ethnohistorian. I think it's a good idea to be trained to do ethnohistory because he used to move between the two. So for me, and but actually, if they wanted to, the problem is I have never seen a program in the UK where you can train.
No, that's very fair. I mean, like I said, before meeting you, I've never heard
And so I don't know. I think you probably have to train in North America. I mean, I did. And I trained at McGill, and I don't know. That's a really tough advice for an ethno historian. Because also it means talking to indigenous peoples, and that takes a lot of time. I think if the person came from the UK, I think you'd probably have to study anthropology and then go into an advanced degree in another school in anthropology, as in another intellectual framework, because the French organize their anthropology differently. It's a really tough question. I can't give you a really easy answer. I know I saw that question and I was like,
It is a tricky one.
that's a really tricky one. I mean, because as I said, for me, it was he decided
Well, it
it.
seems to have worked out quite well, I'd
I
say.
think actually it worked out really well because it meant that I could do follow my, I quote unquote, bad habit of liking crossing disciplinary boundaries. Because and but at the same time, I move spend my time moving between two different worldviews, and I know it's very hard when I have some, I really explain, I have some negative data from the point of view of the outsider archaeology view, and they're not very happy with it. But actually, it's totally understandable once you take that data into the other worldview. You're like, well, of course, it's like, that's of course, you've just applied your views and you're not going to get the answer. So it means that you're move, it's a tough one, actually. I recognize my own biases. Yeah, it's tough. It's not easy because you're perpetually looking at yourself from the other side.
Too much fresh perspective.
That too much fresh
Too
perspective.
much.
You're working out why is that person asking that question? What? How do I organize the world? So you, I think you, re I, you. I can't, I've got to the point where I can't waffle because I need to know. And if someone doesn't make, if their argument doesn't make sense to me, I'll say, well, why does it make sense? Have you not argued it clearly so I can follow every stage along? Or is it that you have just completely different worldview and I have to say, okay, well, what's your worldview? And try and put my head inside your head, which is not easy, but yeah, ethnohistory is fun, but a lot of work.
No, it definitely seems so. But well, in any case, there we are. Thank you ever so much once again for coming on. It's been absolutely brilliant and fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Is there any social media publications, projects that you would like to kind of point people towards if they want to know more about you and what you do?
Okay, I suppose Twitter account as usual. Which is, I think, at Coulson_Lisa, and I have an Instagram which I use just to talk about the sort of talks I'm giving or things like that, which is Alicia_Coulson. Very original, sorry about that. It's called I Can't Think of What to Do. And I do have a website which is Alicia Coulson, and it's a Wix one, so you can more or less Google it. But I just can't remember the long string.
No, that's really fine. I'll write them all down and everything. Yeah.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, there we are. Thank you ever so much, anyone out there watching. And be sure to check out all the other kind of videos that we've done and social media and all the other interviews, because there are some really fascinating people that we've come across so far. Thank you ever so much. And then
thank you.